large volume method of modular stabilization, and then spend the rest of the time talking about basically the connection modulized with flavor, both in how you constrain the form of your Carl couplings and also in flavor and supersymmetry. And as before, please interrupt me as I go along, jump in. Okay, so where I got to last time, so same modular stabilization. So you start off with models with fluxes, and these are characterized by vanishing back, basically no scale property. So they can fix the Dilthoff contact structure moduli, they leave the Kalin moduli unfixed, and they've got a no scale structure with Suzy breaking aligned with the Kalin moduli. Then, proposal to include an observed effect, which is a proposal of KPRT, then that gives you a potential which has a minimum effect for all the moduli. Generically it's got a very large gravitino mass, unless you fine tune, and Suzy is unbroken. So now I want to describe the large volume method, which is that you have potentials for the T moduli. You didn't have any generators by fluxes, so you need to lift that flat direction. So you can lift your flat direction here, and you can also lift the flat direction by including the needing corrections to the Kalin potential. And these descend from an R to the full term in temperatures.
Just to check, when you say KPLT, do you mean without adding anti-D3?
Yes, I think the anti-D3 rate is the least.
Yeah, it's the least understood bit of the whole.
Okay.
Yeah. Volume is, so include alpha prime cube correction to the Kalin potential. Which is entered, let's see if there's a way to catch this. Is entered there with the term proportional to psi. So
now you have a story where you can kind of step down with all the alpha prime corrections.
This is the most important one.
I wasn't
going to, but I certainly can.
Would you?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it takes too much
of your time. No, I mean, it's a reason. I can certainly. I'll do the actual minimum. First of all.
Yeah.
And then I'll discuss that. Yeah.
So that would be the argument as to why that term is capturing all of the various kinds of alpha prime corrections.
Yes. So given that there are loads of corrections in alpha prime cube terms in the 10-dimensional action, not all of whom are known, then why should you focus just on one rather than focus on any of the others?
The argument you make is not specific to tip to B or anything, or is it?
I don't think it's. Yeah. Let me. I'll get to it and then. And then once I go outline the argument, carry on. Okay, so for this construction to work, you need at least two moduli. So at least two Kalin moduli. And one big, one small. Slightly heuristic terminology. So the big one basically controls the overall volume, and the small one is a blow-up modulus, so basically controls the size of a small blow-up cycle inside this large box. So the basic picture, the sort of heuristic picture that we'll go for, is that we have a collider with at least two moduli. So there's one, it's a sort of Swiss cheese picture, quote unquote. So you've got at least two moduli. So one controls the, which we call tau big, controls the size of the overall Calabi-Yau, and then there's another one, tau small, which controls the size of a small blow up inside this large Calabi-Yau. The simplest case is P4111. 6, 9, And for this, you can express the volume of the Calabi Yau in terms of the volumes of the four cycles as follows. Basically, tau big raised to the power 3/2 minus tau small raised to the power 3/2. So this is really good. This is where you get this kind of Swiss cheese. I mean, yes, okay. This is kind of just an intuitive way of thinking of this, but in some sense, you know, this is the controlling the overall size of the space, and this is controlling the size of a sort of a small blown up hole inside the space. But you need this kind of basic geometry for this large volume stabilization method to work. Okay, so how does it go? So if you fix the dilaton and complex structure moduli by solving the flux equations, and then consider the remaining theory of the Kalin moduli. So let me say at this point, it's not a priori guaranteed that it makes sense to first of all fix the dilaton and complex structure moduli and then look at an effective theory for the Kalin moduli and do that separately. It is justified a posteriori, because the fact that one finds a minimum of very large values of the volume essentially means that then the basically all cross couplings between these two sectors are highly suppressed, which justifies that this is a sensible thing to do. But it's perfectly fine to say that a priori this is not necessarily a justified assumption. There isn't a hierarchy in the masses. Right. There's not a hierarchy in the masses. But what there is there's basically the two sectors aren't talking to each other. And this is one of these things that is tied to the fact this is string theory. Naive effective field theory intuition is not holding. And the basic thing is that if you look at the Kalin potential, the Kalin potential is basically a sum of something which depends just on the Kalin moduli plus something which depends just on the complex structure moduli. So then your Kalin metric, the kinetic terms, are looking like this. And these bits in here are zero. At the level of this Kalin potential are actually zero. But in general are just suppressed. And it's the fact that basically so these sectors essentially aren't talking to each other, which is what gives you what makes it okay to do this.
So the suppression is coming from a spin coupling, or is it one of the line?
So the suppression would both be it would be both down, I think both down by volume and down by certainly down by volume. So then the so for this 11169 example, the effective theory for the Kalin potential is okay, so you've got basically this is the minus 2 log volume, this is this effectively this alpha prime cubic correction, and then this is the super potential. You work out the scalar potential. I'm not going to write out the details, but it's just a direct application of using the potential for n=1 supergravity. And you get so comments, the axion part of TS has been put to its minimum. order one factors are left out. Okay, so given this, this is then just a potential for the two fields, tau S and tau B. Oh, yeah, okay, so yes, that's good. Terms that are, this is a large volume limit. So terms that are suppressed by 1 over B are dropped. Okay, yes, so and terms suppressed by e to the minus as. Yeah, so at this point, what's been used basically essentially that the volume is going to be very large and the exponential is going to be very small. So terms that are either suppressed by power of the volume or suppressed by the exponential compared to the terms present here have been dropped.
A was to depend on a complex structure here, you would have a coupling between complex structure and power.
Yes, and the things that in the superpotential, so at the actual minimum, the value of this term here is going to be basically 1 over volume, whereas the value of this, which is the flux term, is order 1. So this is, again, this is part of this decoupling thing that only applies in the limit of large volume. So that, although this does induce an extra term in the complex structure potential, the term is suppressed by 1 over volume at the minimum, around the minimum, which is this a posteriori justification for treating the two segments separately. Any other questions at this point?
So is the residual coupling between the two sectors sufficient that you could have non-perturbative I know that they're suppressed, but I mean, is it possible to? Is there? That's what I'm wondering is if there's some other minimum supposed to equal to a small volume.
In general, there could be a minimum at small volume. I mean, certainly, if you added a term like this to the superpotential, there'd be a kind of KKLT-like minimum at small volume. So, yeah, in general, there could be another minimum at small volume. Yeah.
In the Cantor function, the superpotential, there are no perturbative fractions, and then you have these non perturbative ones that you're taking.
Yeah.
There were perturbative fractions, A and C is one of them. So, for that, two questions would be one is so the things that were not written in A are now in my R is one of the volume.
The additional corrections to K.
I think they're loops, but so they're not only bigger than the exponentials, but they're smaller than the vector.
Yes, yeah, so K is, you're basically expanding in the perturbative corrections to K. Yeah.
So one question is there meaning to keeping C inside the logarithm rather than expanding it out over the first order in C?
Okay, yeah, no, there isn't. I mean, the reason for having it inside the logarithm is essentially this term is, in some sense, is inherited from an n equals 2. Structure where it's there, and in n equals 2 theories, things naturally live inside the logarithm. Yeah, but no, you could just take it outside and write inside.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
In this connection, do we know that actually some finite radius?
In the expansion in
1 over b and.
I've never really thought so. We're expanding about infinite volume.
Well, okay, so at the end of the day, it's not going to be infinite volume. Exactly. At least by our standards. So large compared to the Planck scale, but still not all that.
I mean, it's going to be big. So the volume, the sort of values for the volume I'm interested in are typically like 10 to the 15 or something in string units. So then 1 over V is small, like 10 to the minus 15 or something.
Okay, I'm just asking whether
I'm not. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, maybe it's more volume. The thing that the things break down, but yeah.
Do you be happy with an asymptotic expansion copy? I mean, if I expect it,
yeah.
Hey, Benita, you would say that the company would take ALT students because they don't have a large volume?
So the...
They think
that's
a mass gap.
Yeah, no, KKLT is a mass, has a mass gap because the complex, essentially because the mass scale of the complex structure moduli is basically given by the second derivative of the superpotential. And KKLT, basically, the value of the superpotential is fine-tuned to be very small. So the second derivative, which you normally expect to be the same order of it, is much larger. So the mass here is much larger.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember, I thought there was some claim that still might be dubious.
Yeah, so there was this paper by Troy and Nealers and so on, which said that, I think in the simplest possible case, with just a dilaton, the decoupling failed. But I don't have an opinion on that statement, because I haven't checked it. So.
Not because you don't take that KKLT limit seriously?
Well, so, I mean, The decoupling side of the question, the decoupling question, I just haven't, yeah, it's a well-defined question. I haven't thought about it in the KKLT. I mean, yeah, naively you'd say there's a mass cap, so you can decouple.
Yeah.
But then there is this claim that actually that statement isn't true.
I know there's an issue of you're making W0 exponentially small in tau, and that'll work for large enough fields, but then the question is, can you get far enough in to see the minimum? Is that the issue that they worry about, or is that...
Well, I haven't studied that paper yet, so I'm not having an opinion on it.
It makes
sense. Okay, so this potential you can solve to find, to look for a minimum. If you do this, you find there is a minimum. There's a minimum which exists at tau s, roughly the 2/3 power of psi, and the volume being basically given by the exponential of tau s. And there's a g string over here. Okay, so the key and most interesting feature of this point is that the minimum is at exponentially large volume. Okay, I'm not going to go through the actual solution of these equations because it is just basically straightforward algebra to work out the first derivatives and find where the minimum is.
Will you say why the C term was necessary? Why would we get the same thing if we just got the first derivatives?
So if you just had the first two terms, okay, so the stabilization of tau s comes just from the... Okay, so let me... Okay, if I... Let's get those bits out. If you solve dv by d tau s is zero, then you get this relation that v is approximately e to the as tau s. But the first two terms balance off against each other. Now, if you then integrate out tau s to see what you get as a potential for v, the first two terms in this equation give you basically something that looks like minus log volume to the 3/2 over volume cubed. And this doesn't have a minimum as a potential for the volume. And then if you add psi over volume cubes, you can then see that this is the property that this term wins at small volume, and this term wins at large volume. So if you plot this as a potential for the volume, it looks something like this. And the basic properties I can fill in over here. So the vacuum energy goes as minus m3 half cubed and Planck. The gravitational mass is W0 over volume, which is much, much smaller than M Planck because it's suppressed by the exponentially large volume. Yes, and supersymmetry is broken at the minimum because the F terms for the moduli are non-zero. The masses of the Kähler moduli are, the small one has a mass M3 half log M Planck over M3 half. And the large one has a mass, which is M3 half to the 3 halves divided by M Planck to the 1 half. So note this is much, much smaller than the gravitational mass. But the mass of the large modulus is significantly smaller than the gravitational mass by a factor of volume. And the Dilaton convex structure moduli masses are comparable to the gravitational mass. So a couple of quick comments. Okay, so the small modulus, this hole in the cheese modulus is a lot heavier than the overall volume modulus. And this decoupling between these two. Yeah, so when I said integrate out tau s, this makes sense essentially because the small modulus is heavier than the large modulus by a factor of square root of volume. And the volume at the minimum is enormous. Well, in principle, it's enormous. It can be exponentially large. And so this is a sensible thing to be doing because there's a mass gap between these two.
And which are those is the generic size?
So if you put, if you have a cheese, you can only have one cheese, but you can have lots of holes. So you can have lots of small moduli, lots of different blow-up moduli, but there can only be one.
When you look at the masses, are they all generically log and Planck over m3 halves?
Yes, I mean, if they've got the same structure here with non-perturbative superpotentials. Yeah, I mean, if these things are just basically more copies of tau s, then they've all got the same masses as tau s. And the overall volume modulus always has this mass scale, which is much, much lighter than this.
It may be abusing your analogy, but is there a possibility of the holes becoming comparable in volume? Like the net sum of all the volumes and holes becoming comparable to the total?
Yeah, so if you start, I mean, if you, like, with this expression for the volume tau, so this expression to the volume. So if you blew this up, so you increase the holes to get bigger and bigger and bigger, well, then you get to a point where these things are comparable.
So that's not just one hole. I mean, if you had a bunch of holes, it would be the same as blowing up the volume.
Yeah. So you'd have lots of extra minus signs. Yeah. Yeah. And if they get to be comparable to the size of the overall volume, then these kind of approximations have broken down. Okay, the big plus of these models, I think, is that they address the hierarchy problem. And because they break supersymmetry at hierarchically low energy scales without having put any hierarchically small numbers in. So the minimum of the potential is at a point where supersymmetry is broken at a hierarchically low scale. And so this is what you need to address the hierarchy problem. And so, well, I'm biased, but I think these are a promising starting point. For kind of stringy approaches to phenomenology.
You think it solves both? Because not only the technical natural problem, it solves the problem of why in the first place you would have had a small number.
Yeah, so supersymmetry solves the technical hierarchy problem, But it doesn't solve the weak hierarchy problem because there's nothing in supersymmetry by itself which tells you that the soft terms should be at the weak scale rather than up at the blank scale. And also from a stringy point of view, there's another thing these models kind of enforce on us, which is that if you think about this geometry where you've got basically large bolts with small holes, is the standard model is going to have to be realized basically around one of these holes. So any construction of the standard model in this setup has to be a local construction in the sense that it's going to be living on some small collapsible or blow-up cycle or at a singularity in what's an at least approximately a non-compact space.
Is that because the gauge
couplings
are
tied
to the volume?
Yes, so the gauge couplings of a... So the FA, the gauge kinetic function, which is 1 over g squared for a gauge group, is basically given by the Kähler modulus for a cycle. So this we know has to be around 25, or that kind of order. And if the volume is exponentially large, 25 is not exponentially large. So you have to be wrapping one of these small cycles.
So part of the problem must be you're living off the fact that at the 1 over v cubed level, you have a constant and a log v term. If you now have a cycle which is that size, 25, you've gone through the exercise of showing that there, at the 1 over v cubed level, you don't get additional contributions that are found only by one of that.
So what do you...
So supposing I actually made a geometry where I had a cycle that size, in addition to what you've already had, and I go through and copy the potential again the way you did, and I stop at the 1 over v cubed level, then the statement would be that the 1 over tau, the dangerous 1 over volume is this small one, right? The one that's... So if I look at the corrections to what you've shown, there's something suppressed by volume, and those are really small, but there could be something that's suppressed only by tau.
Okay, so stuff which is suppressed by tau also has a 1 over volume.
Yes, that's always an additional 1 over volume.
Yeah, there's always an additional 1 over volume. Yeah. There are kind of several ways you can see this, but yeah, I mean. Yeah, there's always an addition. You never have stuff which is just tau. Yeah. Okay, so... Yep. Yes, Joe?
Yeah, if you put this 25 in, you get some estimate for how far suppressed gravitational mass is from the plus?
So... Yes, well, so the neurological game you can play is that this you want to be one over volume. So you say that this thing... you expect to be log volume. If the gravitational mass you put as 1 TeV, then the volume has to be 10 to the 15. And so log 10 to the 15 is... log 10 to the 15 is about 30. Yeah, but this is numerology. Yes.
I find a good idea whether it's even working even at this...
Yeah, I mean, this is numerology because, okay, one thing I'm not really interested in, but there's a problem with putting... the standard model on on the same cycle where you have these instanton effects because there's trouble with zero modes. Yeah. But yeah, this numerology. Yeah.
But if you had another cycle guaranteed to exist, it was roughly the same volume as the standard model cycle.
Yes. Yeah. So it's not a prediction of the gauge couplings, but yeah, it's fine. Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna say something about what Cliff asked earlier. About the elephant in the room, which is if you're including one alpha prime cubed correction, why aren't you including every other correction in the effective action? So before that, are there any other questions people want to ask? Anything?
Tell your Kähler modulus lie right in the graph.
Yes, that only the overall volume one.
Only.
Yeah.
The other ones are heavier.
Yeah, the other ones are slightly heavier. I mean, the reason it's so much lighter is because this inherits the no-scale structure, and no-scale's got this massless direction. So you've got the legacy of no-scale. Okay, so say something briefly about other corrections, and then I'll start talking about flavor. Okay, so in the 10D action, so you have the ordinary turn, and then you have lots of other corrections, which are all also the same order as alpha prime cubed, and you expect them all to also correct four-dimensional effective action. So the question is, why should this be the most important one? Well, there's a basic reason for this, which is that fluxes are quantized on three cycles. So, for example, if we compare, say, this term, so G3, the approximate size of G3 is 1 over the volume of the three cycle, the strength of the flux. So if you have a term integral over a Calabi yau, you're looking at an effective term in the effective action like G3 squared R cubed. This scales as a factor of volume for the integral times a factor of 1 over volume for G3 squared times a factor of 1 over volume for the fact you've got R cubed. Whereas if you compare with the term root G R to the 4, then this goes as volume times 1 over volume to the 4/3. And so the point of this is that by looking at the different volume scaling of these terms, you can see that in the limit where the volume becomes really, really large, terms which are involving powers of flux in the 10-dimensional effective action are suppressed compared to terms which just involve curvature, essentially because they'll down by more powers of volume than the terms which just involve curvature. So you can make similar arguments for those. I don't remember the. I mean, we looked at all these at one point, and yeah, the basic conclusion was that everything seems to be down compared to the R to the 4 term.
Is that
necessarily
true for the higher prime corrections?
So one's going beyond above R to the 4.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're suppressed by more powers of length, and every extra power of length you suppress by at large volume is giving you some power of volume. The point is here is, so the leading term is zero, which was the no scale. So then once you go to the first term, you've got something which is non-zero. But there's no reason that the term, but then the term after that is significantly lower than the first term.
This is why you need to do much like that. If you had only one series and you find balance in terms of the end of your problem. If you have two series, you have kind of an A minus tau S series and an RV, and you're kind of balancing them against each other.
Yeah.
So they can both be small.
That is what's happening. So you've got, you're lifting no scale in two ways. You're lifting it from non-perturbative corrections to the superpotential, and also from the perturbative corrections to the Kalin potential. And so those are two separate expansions. And yeah, there's no reason, I guess, this should happen, but it does happen that the first term in both of those expansions balance off against each other to create a non-trivial.
Was it like you're actually going exponentially small when it's...
Yeah. So I think, okay, there is an argument, yeah. it's tied to kind of the scaling scope to Einstein frame. Why you just get you don't just get tau s's, you get tau s's over volume. But I think I don't want to, yeah, get too much into every possible approach that can come in. Just yeah. I've spent quite a lot of time looking at the corrections that can damage this, and yeah, even the ones you think should damage it.
But just to give us a thrust of the argument, the idea is that it's not that you can kind of exhaustively look at everything, it's that there's actually an argument that shows you that the way things scale with the metric, volumes are systematically coming in as a function of derivatives and charts show you that you're expecting it always to be true, not like your swings.
No, yeah, so you mean you can check various, so you can put various things, like you can do like four-dimensional arguments like the Coleman-Weinberg potential, which tell you at what order, what size loop correction should be. And those would turn out to be, because they basically are governed by m3½ squared lambda squared, where lambda's the cutoff. So then if you put lambda to be, mkk or m3, then you'll see that this scale is precisely this 1 over volume cube scale that appears in the potential. You look at a case where people have explicitly computed loop corrections to the Kähler potential, and you can see what form they give, and again, they're down. So.
For the argument, when you argue for the suppression of terms which involve the fraction, do you assume that so the fractions have compound, right?
Yes.
So
it's yeah.
An integer times something, and do you assume that this integer is of order one? Or can it be very, very large?
So it doesn't have to be order one. But basically, whatever number you give me for whatever you think is reasonable as a flux quantum number, I can make the volume. I'm going to push this to the volume big enough that I'm going to win out over your number. Now, if you tell me you think flux quantum numbers of say 10^6 are reasonable, and that all the fluxes are quantized with 10^6 units of charge, this expansion is only going to work if the volume is significantly bigger than around 10^12. But normally, if you say of order 1, order 10, well, then I'll win once the volume starts being. Yeah.
I think we
didn't talk
about Bousov-Borchinsky argument?
Yes, so Bousov-Borchinsky kind of arguments. Yeah, so the flux squared is basically the Euler number of the F34 fold, or the total number of D3 charge states. Like that. And typically, that's around 1,000. So then if you say flux squared is around 1,000, you can then say it's reasonable to have flux quantum number up to say 30.
Up to say 30.
Yeah. Because that's the kind of number I take it
from.
Can I go
back to the small mass of
Yes.
So is this a counterexample to what you were saying yesterday, that when you break super symmetry, all the scalar fields have mass of order of gravity?
Yes, it is. And the reason it's a counterexample is because there's underlying it, there's this no scale structure. And no scale has this property of broken supersymmetry, but a flat direction.
So here, even if you had anything, you already broke supersymmetry, so this guy's getting very massive, even. So somehow there's something that protects the scale. Commanding a supersymmetry breaking.
Yeah, and it's the presence of the no. I mean, the no scale is a very unusual structure, and it has a mass. Yeah, the field which breaks supersymmetry remains flat. And of course, no scale gets violated at loops. So essentially, this particle is getting its mass due to corrections rather than getting its mass due to the physics that actually breaks.
So then you really have a model.
Yes. Yeah.
But you haven't solved it because this part is very low mass.
I'm certainly not claiming to solve cosmology. Yeah, this is probably the biggest problem.
That parametric dependency right down on the M3 mass and Planck up in tree level expression. Take your expect classically. You're not saying that loops parametrically depend in the same way on those masses. You're saying that once you do the loops, you're thinking that loops are smaller than that expression.
Yeah, you take this Kähler potential and super potential, and you work out the masses.
sphere of depression is in the root crisis to that. Are they scaling with the various variables like entry up and playing such a way as to
So I'd say that's the same question as if you take loop corrections, so you can write them as loop corrections to the Kalia potential, and are those loop corrections going to basically alter the structure of the potential, or are they not? So they're not going to alter the structure of the potential, then they're not going to.
Is this going to be true in presence of matter and other maybe Susie brings?
Well, once you start coming down below M3 halves, I would have said that that's not true, that you're just changing to the Kalia potential, because you're assuming you've integrated out super multiples at a time, say you've got a student organized it as a super gravity. If you're relying on the supergravity structure of the ground, you're saying that as I integrate out these heavy modes, I keep things still are characterized by K and W. But if I take out, supposing that I split a supermodel by a certain energy scale of M3 halves, and then I integrate out the thing with M3 halves, and what's left can't be written as a supergravity, it's sometimes a multiple. Then I can't organize the ground in the way that you would want to work.
Yeah, I sort of take that point, but I'm not sure.
It doesn't mean that they're going to be necessarily empty gaps to square or something, but there's an argument.
I'm going to, at this point, stop talking about the moduli stabilization aspect. because I do want to talk about flavor. And if I carry on talking about moduli stabilization, I'm not going to have any time to talk about flavor. So I'm going to use my...
Before you do your exit strategy, do you have a sense of whether that's an unsolved problem or that's something which it's understood and you're choosing unsolved problem right now?
So I guess we've discussed this before. So I guess my is that I don't really feel the strength of the objection is my So I sort of take what you say, but I don't feel it as a strong issue.
Right.
Yeah.
But if the burden of proof was on you, for instance, with the light, then you're saying the best argument you have relies on the structure. So if I had a problem with that argument, then that
would be okay. Well, so I say something like the Coleman-Weinberg potential, which should be working. So something like this. As soon as you put something like M string in here, so you say that the cutoff scale is M string. You say that whatever loop corrections you have to the scalar potential can't be bigger than 1 over volume cubed. And if they can't be bigger than 1 over volume cubed, then because this particle is basically the volume, then that's the same saying that no loop correction to potential can give you a mass that's bigger than this. So, I say, Coleman-Weinberg is good enough for me. An argument like that, this is why I don't really feel...
That's a better argument than the supergravity argument.
Okay. Well, now I really am going to talk about flavor. So I'm going to. Okay. So moduli and flavor. So one definite feature of these models is that supersymmetry breaking is taking place in the T sector. This is the sector of the Kähler moduli, rather than the complex structure sector. And one thing I've also flagged up is that the fact that the Kähler potential factorizes the part that depends on the Kähler moduli and the part that depends on the complex structure moduli. And I also talked about how the shift symmetries of the Kähler moduli mean that basically they can't appear in the superpotential other than exponentially. And if we recall that Yukawa couplings are part, or at least superpotential Yukawa couplings, the main part of Yukawa couplings is coming from the superpotential, then we can see the T and U moduli seem to have quite different roles to play in flavor. Okay, so, and this is now something which is no longer tied to any particular theory of moduli stabilization, but it's something which is, I think, is a very general feature of string compactifications. So, the superpotential is. Now, the Kalin moduli have shift symmetries. So, in 2B, it's the Kalin moduli with the shift symmetries. Shifts under over their imaginary parts. And because they have shift symmetries, then this means that the T moduli do not appear in the perturbative superpotential. And because they do not appear in the perturbative superpotential, they also do not appear in the part of the superpotential that is giving you your color couplings. Okay, now why? Okay, now this one thing this does is this kind of significantly restricts the forms, at least in my mind, it significantly restricts the forms of your color couplings that can arise in string theory. So, for example, so why is this? Well, one point about this is that the. Okay, so this is saying that in 2B, you should have yijk, should be yijk of u, without any t-dependence. Okay, so why is this important? Well, for one reason, is that the Kalin moduli also have another role, which is they also set the gauge couplings. So in particular, if you've got some stack of brains, then the gauge kinetic function of that stack of brains is given by a Kalin modulus. And this is equivalent to saying that 1 over g squared for that is given by a Kalin modulus, which we'll denote Tsm for T standard model. So, and this is 1 over alpha for that. That the gauge group is living on those brains. So, for example, there have been these claims that have occurred in the context of some like F theory guts that you can get, for example, Yukawa couplings and CK matrices that you can expand in powers of alpha gut. So the question is, can you get Yukawas as an expansion in alpha gut? And given seeing that alpha gut is given by Kalin moduli, to me this seems a little implausible. So this would require a Yukawa coupling matrix. So say, for example, that you have there are these claims that you can get the uptype Yukawas coming as roughly as alpha gut to the 4, alpha gut squared to 1. But a serious problem with this is that the superpotential cannot depend on T, and so cannot depend on alpha gut. And so if the superpotential can't depend on alpha gut, then you know, it doesn't seem possible to get such kind of flavor expansions where you expand the Yukawa couplings in terms of powers of alpha gut, as it seems incompatible with holomorphy.
But I missed something. So you're getting standard model
for
Why do you have
gut? So either standard model or gut models, or whatever your idea for the beyond the standard model.
Can you get that from the... So in this story, I thought you have an intersecting brain, deep brain interrupting various cycles. So
there's no gain
unification.
So this depends. I mean, you know, so although all my talk about moduli stabilization in terms of Clarke-Yau, you know, this is all 2B. I mean, there's a very close relation between, D3, D7, and F theory. So for example, Joe and Natalia are kind of experts on this next year. So
you're saying that Is your theory type 2B or something more general?
So 2B, D3, D7 is very closely related to F theory. Yeah. So, F theory has these oriented fold limits, in which case you're just in a 2B, D3, D7 case. So, even though the moduli stabilization here is, strictly, in some sense, talking about alpha prime corrections is, if it's going to be strict, is in the 2B setting. The setting is very closely related to things like F theory. And one would expect it to carry across to a certain extent.
So if you start with one type of D-break, somehow you need to break the gauge symmetry into standard model gauge, right?
There are the ideas like hypercharge fluxes. As on in the F theory context. I mean, with this kind of thing, I mean, the moduli sector here is all pretty similar between 2B and F theory. Things like Kähler moduli, are just going across. So,
yeah.
Your point is that the things that they're using for this kind of state fit into your framework.
Well, so I want to be more general on this. So, in any kind of string framework where you're getting an effective supergravity at low energy, there is a chiral superfield that is responsible for the gauge couplings, and the imaginary part of that chiral superfield is an axiom, because that's just how. And then if you have something whose imaginary part is an axiom, they've got a shift symmetry. And because it's got a shift symmetry, whatever field is responsible for the gauge couplings shouldn't be appearing in the superpotential, because its imaginary part is an axiom.
What are the models that satisfy that? You're saying include the F3 model with
their... Yeah, but they include basically all string compactifications. Yeah.
Is it an inherent caveat that this is a perturbative superpotential?
It's the perturbative superpotential, but this kind of thing is a perturbative expansion.
You can have alpha gut dependence if there was some e to the alpha gut with it.
Yes. Yeah.
So it will just be a difference scaling, but you could have it.
So you could certainly have non-perturbative effects. Yeah.
Can I ask just about non-perturbative effect, pretty quick question? In your original model with D4, it was very explicit. Is it known that the instanton that you use for tau s actually really exists in that caveat?
The 11169.
Yeah, the 11169.
So it is known, but not by me. So there's a paper by Dennis Douglas and Floria. Uh-huh. Yeah, and they say that they've computed things and it's there.
So the instanton actually does exist.
Yeah. Now I'm just accepting what they say. So that's what I meant by it's known but not by me. Yeah, I'm taking it on trust that they're correct.
Let's take the JK master.
What's his name? You mean Seti?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so just one quick comment. One possible get out of this is that physical Yukawas also have factors of the kinetic terms in. And in principle, you could have different family dependents. Of the kinetic terms to try and get their different family dependence in the physical Yukawa couplings with the Kähler moduli. There are sort of two problems with that. No, I know. So first of all, if you look at the kind of form of the Yukawas that you acquire, you need kinetic terms that diverge in the weak coupling limit, so that they go to infinity in the weak coupling limit.
Those are the coefficients of kinetic terms for the various
families. Yes, yeah. So the problem seems that if you want to get this kind of structure, then you need a form of kinetic terms that basically diverge into infinity as you take a weak coupling limit where all the couplings go to zero. And the second problem, which leads on to what I'm going to go and talk about next, is that this isn't seen in metro models. So they're in the cases where people have actually computed these ZI. This kind of family non-universal behavior has never been seen. And there are kind of actually reasons why these things should be family universal. So that if you have things of the same gauge charge, and then the different families,
So everything within the family of the sex is the same, but everything with a different
family of the family. Yeah, so I mean, the fields with different gauge charges can have different behavior. But for the fields with the same gauge charge, but just different, so things like, arc charm and charm. Oh, so I can't see how these kind of structures can be made compatible with holomorphy.
Can we make compatible with
holomorphy?
So maybe the way of it's the same conversation we had. I mean, if you raise this percentage breaking scale in China, so then I'm not sure exactly what the relevant scale is at all for ones you have. And at some point, holomorphy is not going to be controlled.
Yes, so that if flavor basically is generated below the supersymmetry breaking scale, then these arguments are, do not apply.
But is there a window if you wanted to, if you're using supersymmetry to solve the hierarchy problem, I guess the problem is you don't have a window?
So, I mean, I think there are some papers in the phonological literature. I mean, there have been ideas in the, to get different fermial masses as. I mean, this is dealing with things where the Yukawa, where flavor is generated at the high scale, where flavor, can you have this kind of expansion generated at the high scale in a supersymmetric theory? Yeah. If flavor is tied to supersymmetry breaking.
You're not making that generalization. I thought you were saying that in a supersymmetric theory which has conditioned all these axions and things, there are something we can do. That specific class makes
more string
theory.
Okay, but that's pretty much all kind of things coming from string theory. I'm thinking within the context of string ratifications. Okay, so I want to talk a bit about flavor in supersymmetry breaking. The properties of soft terms. So,
just so you can figure out where you're going. So, are you regarding this as being a reason to stop thinking of these models, or this is the warm up for something you're now going to solve this problem?
No, so okay, I'm not going to talk more about flavor and Yukawa couplings. I'm putting this in. I think this is an example of the use of moduli to get constraints on effective actions, and how things like Yukawa couplings can appear. In effective actions. Specifically, the symmetries of the moduli tell you that things like the superpotential, the Yukawa couplings, can't depend on certain moduli.
And the message is about it, right? So this is, the generic thing is it doesn't work. If you'd like to get all the generations.
So to my mind, it causes a problem for the models where you want to get the Yukawa couplings as expansions in alpha cup.
You just said that if you look at all the examples people look at, they I guess what I'm trying to get at is how generic the problem is. The problem was that you work all the generations the same things with the same gauge curve as you said at the same size.
So like 100 is a common texture in string compactifications. The problem is how are you going to generate the fermial masses in the context of string compactifications? Yeah, so what's the thing that's going to make the fermion masses small? And I say what it makes very hard to do is to make them small by having them as an expansion in something like alpha gut or the gauge couplings. I'm not going to solve this problem. No, I mean, you could have things depending, for example, on the complex structure moduli.
mention Debsy, maybe you should also mention that there is a proposal how to solve hierarchy problems there. Because you presented as if in all this class of models it's not possible to solve this problem, but there was a proposal, right?
With the flavor. With these fluxes.
Yeah,
So there's been, because there've been several papers on that. So there was the original thing which said that their existence generates corrections to the 100. But then there was a statement that these only arise non-perturbatively. And then there was this paper by Cashew and so on saying that you can reconcile this through these. Like D7, non-perturbative effects on D7 brains induce essentially
the edge, right? But originally it was proposed by Graf and company, right, that you switch on each flux, which could cause non-commutative deformation of your gauge theory on these brains, and so you get this effect over favorable hierarchy.
So the claim that it goes from 100 to what? So the original Zapata paper, the first one, they're still claiming there's expansion in alpha gut. In the sense when they estimate, they try to estimate the H flux, and they're putting alpha gut in there.
They want to say that their expansion parameter in their model is roughly the same size. They're claiming they're not doing an expansion of KW5, but the end result is that.
Yeah, that I don't understand how that. I'm not saying they can't be.
More specifically, they're getting basically one alpha alpha.
Yeah.
Some alpha.
Yeah, that I'm not. Yeah, if you say that alpha is the same as alpha gar.
No, one alpha alpha square, and there's a question of.
Yeah.
In the actual model, you evaluate this alpha alpha.
Yeah.
And they have some argument that it is the same.
Well, then I think once you say it's the same as alpha gar, then I think you run into all these problems with holomorphy, because you say that if you have to, this should be describable in an effective action.
My setting's it's not exactly the same.
No, but
it's called heuristic. I don't want to get into it, but anyway, they get one alpha alpha.
That sort of thing. Yeah, I'm saying that if it's one, I'm saying the arguments with moduli argue against things which go like one alpha gut squared. If you remove the gut from here and just say it's a small parameter. These more general arguments don't say anything about that.
But you're saying there's some other small parameter that coincidentally is the same as alpha gut. Is there a sense of what other thing?
No? Okay. Okay, so say something about supersymmetry breaking. Okay, so one of the biggest questions of supersymmetry breaking is the flavor problem, which can be roughly summarized as, if supersymmetry exists, why hasn't it been discovered already? Okay, so Susie and Flavor. So things like KK bar mixing. Branching ratio of mu to E gamma. All these basically highly constrain the flavor structure of supersymmetry with the effect that essentially you need flavor universal. Flavor universal score perceptual masses, A terms that are proportional to the Yukawa couplings, and universal phases for Gugino masses. So I is going over each different type of Yukawa coupling. So, like up-type Yukawa couplings, down-type Yukawa couplings, lepton Yukawa couplings. Okay, so basically you require that for each different type of charged particle, each different set of gauge charges, the scalar masses should be universal, the A temp should be proportional to the Kawas, and the phases of the gauge masses you also want to be identical. So there are various proposals to address this. So one popular idea, particularly on this side of the Atlantic, is gauge mediation, although it's only a partial solution because in general you still get large CP violation. So the logic for gauge mediation normally relies on a claim that gravity mediation generically gives large flavour violation. And the argument for this is that soft terms come from that if X is a field that breaks supersymmetry, then the claim is that this you have this term in the effective action to generate soft masses. If Cij is generic or anarchic, then you get arbitrary flavour violation, and this is bad. Okay, now, so one thing I think is that this is very much an effective field theory argument, and, well, the theme of my talks is really that I think, yeah, string theory reaches parts that effective field theory doesn't. And so statements about M-Planck suppressed couplings should be studied in string theory.
You make it sound like string theory is special that way. I mean, effective field theory always has an initial where you match up the upper theory. And you're just saying that string theory is telling you what those initial conditions are.
So, okay, so the argument that's, you know, the argument here is essentially that quantum gravity does not have any global symmetries or doesn't have any special symmetries. You know, this is a Planck suppressed term. So because there aren't any symmetries to forbid it. So you expect this term to appear in the Lagrangian with generic order one coefficients to Cij with no special structure.
The last thing is a kind of a
Yes, but this is an argument that is frequently made.
Yes.
Cliff, I remember reading your article. What was it? An ode to effective field theory? Is? I remember not to diss effective field theory in your presence. Yeah.
But it's also not special to string theory, right?
I don't think we'll disagree. Okay, so I want to just write up some conditions which will give you conditions on supersymmetry breaking, which will give you flavour universality. So. And then we'll see how the moduli come into this. So conditions for flavour universality. Okay, so these are basically sufficient conditions to get flavour universality. So the hidden sector fields divide into two kinds, which I call psi and chi. And the psi and chi kinetic terms decouple. So you can write the Lagrangian, not the sorry, not the Lagrangian, you can write the kinetic terms for these fields as a block diagonal. The superpotential Yukawas depend only on chi. So while in principle that these it could depend on either, it only depends on one. The chi fields, which we call the flavor fields, and the gauge kinetic function goes the other way and only depends on the psi fields. So we're essentially building up two sectors that aren't talking to each other. And we carry on with that with the matter terms. The fourth condition is that the matter metric factorizes. So the matter metric is in principle a generic function of all of these guys. Say that if it's just a function, it's a universal function of the psi times an arbitrary function of the psi. And finally, final statement is that the dynamics of the vacuum is such that psi breaks Susie and chi preserves F. So F psi is non-zero and F chi is zero. Okay, so what the statement is here, so this is just not knowing about something like string theory, you've just got a general supergravity theory, that if these conditions are satisfied, then everything is going to be hunky-dory and all your soft terms are going to be flaky. So what are the conditions? You divide the hidden sector fields into two kinds. One is kind of responsible for flavour, generating flavour, and the other is responsible for supersymmetry breaking. You separate the kinetic terms so that these fields aren't talking to each other. The Yukawa couplings, based on the origin of flavour, are depending only on one kind of fields, the flavour fields, and the gauge kinetic functions are only depending on the other kind of field. The matter metric is factorising, so that there's basically a universal flavour-independent part which depends on the psi's, and then you can have an arbitrary dependence on the chi's. And finally, it's the psi fields are breaking supersymmetry, so have non-zero F terms, and the chi fields, which are essentially the flavour fields, are preserving it. Now,
so was that, this is all a sufficient scenario? It's not necessarily necessary, or it's the only one we know about?
It's a sufficient scenario.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so essentially we're dividing the hidden fields into two components, one Susy breaking and one flavour generating. And while this is totally ad hoc and artificial at the level of just writing down actions, I mean, the reason I've kind of presented it this way is that this is kind of, you know, this structure is very naturally realised in string theory. So in particular, the identification I want to make is to identify psi with the Kähler moduli and chi with complex structure. Moduli. And so, okay, so then let's run through these various conditions. Okay, so dividing them is into two kinds. Well, that's easy. I just say all the moduli, you know, are either Kähler or complex structure. The fact that the kinetic terms decouple is a property of string compactifications at leading order. Where does it come from? So what's the origin of this decoupling? Well, essentially it's because the Kähler potential is inherited from the underlying n equals 2 structure of Kolabi-Yau compactifications. And so the factorized kinetic terms are inherited from n equals 2. In n equals 2, you have hypermultiplets and vector multiplets, and it's just a fact about n equals 2 supersymmetry that these have no cross terms in their kinetic matrices. So these hypers and vectors don't mix, and that's just a property of n equals 2 supersymmetry. And that the structure of Kolabi-Yau geometry is inheriting the n equals 2 structure, the same is holding true here.
Is that
that point is addressing point two.
That is addressing point two. Point three, the superpotential you have is only dependent on one kind. Well, this is, again, this is a property of the shift symmetry of the Kähler moduli, which means that at least perturbatively, the superpotentials can depend on the complex structure moduli, but they can't depend on the Kähler moduli, because the shift symmetry T to T plus I epsilon addresses point three. Point five, so it's a property of flux compactifications. So this is something that didn't have to be true a priori, but it is a property of flux compactifications that supersymmetry breaking is concentrated in the Kähler moduli. And the complex structure moduli do not break supersymmetry. Certainly, yeah, there will be subleading corrections which will cause, you know, a leakage from FT into FU, but this will be suppressed in a large volume limit. And finally, property four, the factorization of the Kähler metric. So let me just give two comments on that. So the first, which is the more Fiat-like comment, is that it is true that in computed examples this factorized structure is present. So I'll just have to comment on that. So let me give you a formula for the once I find it. So for a formula for, in the case of toroidal intersecting grain models, then, so for toroidal intersecting grain models, this is something which is computed to all orders in alpha prime. So let me give you the expression for the physical Yukawa couplings. The physical Yukawa couplings, so the statement four about the factorization is equivalent to the statement that the physical Yukawa couplings factorize, because you could move the kinetic terms into the physical Yukawa couplings. So it's the same statement. And the physical Yukawa couplings look like, so this is for D9 brains. So to all orders in alpha prime and to leading order in G string, it factorizes into a universal Kähler moduli dependence and a non-universal U moduli dependent part. So, okay, I'm not going to explain all the notation here. These phis are basically related to the angles at which brains are intersecting. The basic point is that for models of, these are D9 brains with the magnetic fluxes on tori, that you do have this factorization into a universal dependence on the Kähler moduli, and then the flavor structure is all contained within the U moduli, which is precisely the same as the point four up there, that the Kähler moduli dependence is universal, and the complex structure moduli dependence, you know, is where the information is carried, or flavor is carried.
Is this something that came out without putting it in, or did you start by looking for something that had to? I mean, within this work example, is it something that they were looking for to encode the flavor structure from the
structure?
Or is that the only way they could get it?
In this example, in this case, this is just, people are interested in studying Yukawa couplings on intersecting brains because intersecting brains are a fashionable topic. And so people were just going and just computing things. And so there are all these.
So it just turned out that for intersecting brains and all of the flavor structure, if you get the friendly restrictor, you ended up having put in this kind of structure with complex moduli, and that was where the flavor.
Yes, yeah, so it sort of came out that this kind of factorization isn't kind of emphasized in this kind of literature because it's got a different aim. But okay, so the fact that this is to all orders in alpha prime is quite interesting. But one can give a pretty simple argument: the basis of this factorization should hold a leading order in alpha prime, which is kind of a very low check argument. And with this low check argument, I want to end the talk. So the low-check argument is, in 2B setups, flavor comes from wave, but not flavor, but Yukawa couplings come from wave function overlap. So you have three wave functions, and you basically overlap them, and you do a triple intersection. And this triple intersection gives you the Yukawa couplings. So what we want is the dependence of these terms on the Kähler moduli. And because this part cannot depend on the Kähler moduli, we know that basically what this gives us is Ki basically tells us how the Yukawas scale under metric rescalings. So as we take these things and then we scale them so they're bigger, the information carried here is the information on how this overlap changes as you change the metric. And here the basic point is that we get flavor by solving the Dirac equation. And you get different families through the fact that the Dirac equation in a flux background, there's an index that counts the number of solutions, and there's multiple solutions. And the solutions of the Dirac equation don't care about metric rescalings. So, i.e., if you just rescale the metric, you still get the same solutions. So because you still get the same solutions, then the wave functions, you need to normalize wave functions so that they're normalized and you integrate to 1. And then the Yukawa coupling comes from the triple overlap. But the only thing this information is carrying is basically how things behave under metric scalings. And that has got no information about flavor, because when you rescale the metric and the Dirac equation, you still get precisely the same solutions. So that isn't carrying information about flavor. And so a leading order, this just carries, kind of almost trivial information about how the leading order in T, Ki just carries almost trivial information about how solutions scale with the metric. And this is, you know, the kind of intuitive reason for why this has got basically, this, you know, at least the leading order in alpha prime, this is a very simple dependence on the Caleb watch light.
It's true if you have different rescalings and you have multiple here, then you won't have different, you can rescale different cycles.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, in the cases where I've applied this, that hasn't been an issue, because either because you've basically got stuff that's all localized and you can reduce things to just a rescaling of the local metric, or that you're doing an overall rescaling with the overall metric of the entire space. Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I'm not sure what the answer is.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're assuming you have only one gear modulus. You have one rescaling. I can see one rescaling just factoring out. If you were have many different rescalings going on at the same time, that's true.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's interesting. I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, for the, yeah, the toroidal models over there have got multiple. I've got multiple moduli. And yeah, but yeah, I'm not sure. For a general curve space, I'm not sure. Okay, but I think I should finish now. So yeah, so this is the final point. My point is, yeah, so that this structure, which is quite artificial in just pure writing down effective Lagrangians, occurs rather naturally in string theory, and it naturally gives flavor universal soft terms. And so my take on this is, you know, if our best candidate for UV theory naturally gives a flavor conserving structure, then yeah, it's good to use it. Okay, thanks for attending and for asking all your interesting questions.